Hi, this is Jim Armstrong, and today we're doing Module 7, Consumer Education, Positioning Yourself as a Trusted Advisor, and Charging Higher Prices Than Your Competitors. And I'm very honored to have Dr. Larry Steinmetz on the call with us today. Larry is president of High Yield Management, Inc., and is one of the nation's foremost authorities on selling products and services at higher prices than one's competitors. He is the author of the masterful book, How to Sell at Prices Higher Than Your Competitors, which I have here on my desk, and it is the focus of today's teleseminar, and he has taught the ideas in his book to thousands of salespeople across the country, including public seminars, private coaching, Fortune 500 companies, and others. The back of Larry's book has a quote that says, "Any idiot can give stuff away by cutting the other guy's price. Selling occurs when your prices are higher, but you are still able to close the deal. If you want to give stuff away, get a job at the welfare department. If you want to learn how to sell at a high price, read this book. It's about making money by selling." Larry, welcome to the call, and thank you for being here.
Jim, glad to be here.
All right, now, Larry, in chapter one of your book, it's titled, "Most Businesses Fail or Go Broke, and Yours Can Too." How does that relate to price?
Well, most businesses do go broke. Most of them that do broke cutting price. 16 out of 17 businesses in the United States that will start will fail, most of them in the first few years of their existence. Average life expectation for all business in the United States, only 7.5 years. In fact, one of the lines I use in a public seminar that I do is this: if your business is not 8 years old, the odds are it never will be. And, you know, it's something that people do to themselves. Most all businesses that fail begin to experience a declining gross margin, and that always indicates too low pricing in what they're selling.
Okay. And what are the danger signs that a company is headed for bankruptcy?
Well, there are three that I point out in the book. One I just said, which is the major one, the one that everybody should look at, which is declining gross margin. When businesses get into trouble in the United States for operational reasons, I mean, there are other reasons businesses get into trouble, for example, a hurricane, you know, or those kinds of things. But short of calamity, for operational reasons, when businesses go broke, three things occur. Number one, gross margin begins to decline. Number two, wages as a percentage of sales begin to increase. And believe this or not, number three, they tend to begin to experience a sales volume increase. Now, the problem is all three of those things get wrapped around the axle, so to speak, which heralds doom for the company. The only way gross margin can go down is because the selling price is too low. For example, if you're selling something for $100 and it costs you $65, your gross margin's $35. Well, if you cut the price by $5 to $95, your gross margin dollars go down to $30. That's a little more than 30%, but it's not nowhere close to the $35 that you had.
Okay.
Second way that happens is you don't cut your price, but your cost of goods sold go up, say, from $65 to $70. Okay, you still got a 30% gross margin then. Third way that happens, and we're still working on gross margin, remember, your costs go up, say, $5 from $65 to $70, and by jingles, you raise your price by $5 from $100 to $105. You still got $35, but you no longer have a 35% gross margin. So the point is, whenever your gross margin begins to erode in a business, that is a terrible danger sign from an operational standpoint. The second thing, and Jim, if you don't mind me editorializing on this, because I know we've got a bunch of entrepreneurs in floor covering business here, and they do need to know this, even though we'll probably talk more about pricing and gross margin.
No, please do.
Yeah, well, wages as a percentage of sales tend to start going up, and that boils down to two things. Either paying too high wages, which most business owners try to avoid doing. They try to control, you know, they try to be reasonable, pay a fair wage, but you know, you got to watch how much you're paying.
Sure.
So that's not usually the problem. Where wages percentage of sales tend to start going up is they have too many people on the payroll. Simply stated, you got four people on a payroll and you could be getting by with three, your wages as a percentage of sales are going to be too high and are going to continue to go up even if you're paying miserly wages. And then the third thing, sales volume increases. Normally, when businesses get into trouble, they'll experience a sales volume increase because what the people running the business do, well, they get into trouble. Financial trouble in a business is you can't pay your bills. Can't pay your bills, got to get some cash.
Sure.
How to get some cash, got to sell something. How to sell something? Cut the price. That's invariably what everybody does. Okay, you cut the price, and you'll probably start experiencing a sales volume increase, increased cash flow, but your margin has gone down. Now, when you cut price, did you cut payroll? Did you, when you cut your price by 10%, did you cut what you're paying your people by 10%? No. So wages percentage of sales start going up, and there you've got, you know, the perfect storm, if you will. And, you know, if any of our listeners today want to monitor their own business, I would recommend that they get out their books and take a look at their historical gross margin, and has it been going down, at their wages as a percentage of sales. And when I say wages as a percentage of sales, don't include the owner's wages in there, because owners often do take money, if they're profitable, that is not really payroll.
Okay.
So just, you know, monitor wages as a percentage of sales. And most of these guys probably using some kind of a bookkeeper or accountant, and just tell them, you know, give me what my payroll is, excluding, you know, assuming that they're the owner, excluding owner wages out of that. And monitor that if it has been going up. And then, you know, look at your top line, your sales volume. If it's been going up, gross margin's going down, wages percentage of sales going up, you're going to hell in a handbasket.
Okay, and anybody that is listening to this later on in audio form, I recommend, Larry just went through a lot of things to consider there, historical gross margins, wages as a percentage of gross sales. Go back, re-listen to that, take notes, and start tracking that as part of your business history. Now, why is business a game of margins and not of volume?
Well, it's simple. If you're making your margins, you ultimately will be profitable irrespective of your volume. This is the way I try to frame it when I'm running seminars and, you know, live teaching people, those kinds of things, with this question: do you want to be big or do you want to be profitable? Do you want to be the biggest one in the business or do you want to be the last one in the business? Most companies go broke. They go broke cutting price with increasing sales volume. And again, I cannot emphasize that point enough. They lose their margins. Everybody seems to be volume oriented. Everybody seems to think big is better. Hey, I don't care how big you are, if you're unprofitable, ultimately your company's going to go broke. You know, when I said 16 out of 17 businesses fail, you know, most of them in the first few years of their existence, I think most people think, well, he's talking about little businesses. No. Big businesses fail. Giant businesses fail. The largest corporations in the world failed. And, of course, you know what's going on today. General Motors may be failing. You know, when I was in school, they told me, as goes General Motors, so goes the nation. Well, yeah, well, that may be getting political, so I won't have to go
okay.
on that. But let me give you a quotation. Tom Watson, Jr. was the guy who built IBM. IBM, in its heyday, was the world's most successful corporation. Today, I guess you'd argue maybe it's Microsoft, you know, in terms of profitability and so forth. But big businesses fail. I want to read to you, because this is something I do in my seminars. This is just a short paragraph and a half, if you will.
Oh, please.
But the first page of Tom Watson's book, and I'll cite it, the title of his book is A Business and Its Beliefs, The Ideas That Helped Build IBM, was published by McGraw-Hill in 1968. And Tom Watson, these are the first words he wrote in his book, If You Think Big Businesses Don't Fail. And I'll quote Watson's book right now. And keep in mind, this was written in 1968. I'll update it to today when I finish. Here we go. Quote, of the top 25 industrial corporations in the United States in 1900, only two remain in that select company today. One retains its original identity. The other is a merger of seven corporations on that original list. Two of those 25 failed. Three others have merged and dropped behind. The remaining 12 have continued in business, but each has fallen substantially in its standing. Figures like these help to remind us that corporations are expendable and that success, at best, is an impermanent achievement which can always slip out of hand. Close quote. Now let me update it to today. Of the top 25 industrial corporations in the United States in 1900, only one remains in that select company today. You want to know who that is? General Electric. And you know what's happening to General Electric today. You know, in another 20 years, to update that to, you know, the year 2028, it may be of the top 25 industrial corporations in the United States, none remain in that select company today. You know, don't ever feel that your business can get big enough in volume that it is immune to failure or the vagaries of the marketplace. It's just that simple. Business is a game of margins. You make your margins, you're going to make money. You do volume, you're going to work and work and work, and you may not make any money, and then you may end up going broke, tired.
Yeah, that two things stand out that makes me think of is, you know, sometimes people are going broke so slowly they don't realize it.
Yeah.
Sort of a slow death.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. And another thing, Dan Kennedy talks about one of his early mentors who said, if we've got enough gross, there's got to be some net around here somewhere.
Yeah. Well, but that's not true.
That's right.
That's absolutely not true.
Okay. Well, Larry, what about someone who says, my competition keeps cutting my price?
Well, simple answer to that, that's a lie. Let me confront this head on. Competition does not cut your price. You do. You say those words. You write those numbers down on a piece of paper. You submit that bid. You write up that quotation. You print up that catalog, that ad. You respond to that fax. You answer that email. You cut your price. Pogo the Possum years ago said it all when he said, we have found the enemy and he is us. Don't go blaming your low price on your competition. Your competitor may very well be cutting his price or her price. You cut your price. And until a person is willing to understand that, they want to blame all their problems on somebody else. One more time, if your price gets cut, it's because you said to your customer or prospective customers, I am willing to do this work, I am willing to install this job, I am willing to sell you this material for less money than I should be selling it to you for. And that's something you do to yourself.
Yeah, so that's a mind shift that everyone should make. You control your destiny. You're the captain of the ship. Now, I've heard people say, well, my customers only care about cheap price. So what would you say to that, Larry?
Well, what I'd say to that is buyers make good liars. The most proficient liars in the world are people who are buying things. You, Jim, and I become better liars when we go to buying. I'm sure you would admit to something that I will admit to. Somebody, I'm wanting to buy something and somebody tells me how much it is and I tell them, you know, I can't pay that kind of money. I'm not going to pay that kind of money. Price is the only thing I look at. I can get the same stuff down the street for less money. You're a flaming idiot, blah, blah, blah. That is part of this negotiation process of buying and selling. A customer will tell you all they care about is price, but the facts are their behavior belies that. People don't buy on price. You know, simple question. You're wearing the cheapest shirt you could buy. You're wearing the cheapest shoes you could buy. Or you're driving the cheapest car you could buy. Or you're living in the cheapest house you could buy. You're living in the cheapest apartment you can rent. Are you buying the cheapest food you can find at the grocery store? Yeah, it's simply not true. People will tell you that they buy strictly on price because they are trying to get you to cut your price. See, your customer knows your competition does not cut your price. Your customer knows if they're going to get you to sell to them, to install a job for them, to do work for them at a lower price, the only way they can get you to do that is to get you to cut your price. So they're going to focus the attention on price and try to make you think price is the only thing. And then, of course, the seller is fearful that he or she is going to lose the sale. And, you know, what happens then, let's talk in terms of salespeople and so forth. Another line I like to use is this. Most pressure in most companies to cut price comes from the sales force, not from the customer. And if you don't believe that, maybe I can restate it. Virtually all resistance to raising price comes from the sales force. A sales rep will start complaining about a price increase before they even talk to a customer about it. You know, we're talking to owners and bosses. You know, you suggest to a sales rep, we're going to raise the price. What's the first reaction you get? What? Are you insane? We're already higher priced than anybody in the country. We're going to lose all our sales. And, you know, you haven't even talked to the customer yet. The sales rep hasn't even laid the price on a customer yet. And they're the ones that are telling you our prices are too high. We got to get competitive. You know, get competitive. Be competitive are euphemisms that people use to cut the price. Sales rep will say to the boss, we got to get competitive. We got to be competitive. The customer will say to the sales rep or to the boss, if the boss is doing the selling, you got to get competitive. You got to be competitive. They always mean cut the price because they know if they don't get you to cut your own price, they're not going to get it for a lower price.
Yeah, and you've said, I've heard you say before, Larry, that if they could get it at the lower price down the street, why are they talking to you in the first place?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, you know, there's a lot of economic turmoil right now, and this has driven a lot of people to make the mistake of lowering their prices. And on the surface, you know, that might sound like a good idea to some. What are your thoughts on that, and what should floor covering dealers be doing in regards to price?
Well, price cutting is rarely a good idea. Now, there are times when there is no other alternative than to cut price. But the first thing any floor covering dealer or any business person, for that matter, wants to do when the price pressure comes is ask yourself, are you really trying to sell this customer? You see, we know people don't buy on price. They say they do. They believe they do. They'll absolutely tell you they do, but they don't. Like I said, are you wearing the cheapest shirt you could buy, driving the cheapest car, etc.? So when the price pressure hits you, the temptation is to be accommodating and cut the customer some kind of a deal rather than to emphasize selling on other competitive bases. You see, fundamentally, in my book, I claim there are five basic aspects that anybody sells anything on. I refer to it as competitive edge. One is price. I'll not deny that you can sell on price. You absolutely can sell on price. But if you sell on price, you may very well not survive. One of the quotes I like to use that's in the book, you know, David Glass was president of Walmart. Sam Walton, of course, started Walmart. David Glass was his first employee. David Glass, Sam Walton apparently were childhood playmates in Missouri growing up together. And when Sam started Walmart, he needed to start, you know, needed some help. He hired David Glass, his buddy, and ended up, David Glass was president of Walmart. Sam, of course, was chairman of the board. He got cancer and he passed away. But the quote I'm driving at, and this is out of Fortune magazine. David Glass was interviewed by Fortune magazine. I've got a copy of it here in my hand. I want to give you a short little quote from it. David Glass is quoted as saying, quote, "Recently he was looking at a list of the top 10 discounters in 1962, which is the year Kmart, Walmart, and Target started operating. Not one of those 10 even exists today." Close quote. Now, what that means is in 1962, okay, we're going back nearly 50 years, there were discounters. The 10 largest discounters in 1962 that were in business when Kmart, Walmart, and Target started operating, none of those 10 exist anymore. Now, if price, low price, would ensure success, where did these 10 largest discounters of 50 years ago go? They went broke. That's where they went.
Exactly.
You see, price, low price does not assure success. Again, it comes back to the game of margins that we were talking about. So, you know, you can't go to price. Well, what are the other five or remaining four factors of your competitive edge? Okay, one is quality. You learn to sell on quality. One is service. You sell service. A couple of definitions of service. Service is being willing to do for the customer what the customer wants you to do, especially if your competition cannot or will not provide that service. Most businesses claim they give terrific service. I would argue very few do. And the reason I say that is most businesses will tell you they give terrific service, but they really don't. For example, you've heard this advertised on radio or television. We're your full-service bank. We're open from 10 to 3. If they're my full-service bank, why are they open from 10 to 3? Why aren't they open from 3 to 10 p.m.? You know, I don't have to take off work to buy groceries. I can buy groceries 24 hours a day. Why do I have to take off work to go down to the bank to borrow money if they're my full-service bank? You see, and there, you know, there's tons of examples like that. Another definition of service is this. This is more of a statement than a definition, but service, you define it for your customer, or your customer will have to define it for you. And if that happens, you'll be tarred with your competitor's brush. Let me translate that. Either you, the seller, learn to get in a customer's face and explain to them, tell them, sell them what all you are going to do for them, or your customer will have to decide what it is you're going to do, and they will assume you're every bit as bad, if not worse, than your competition. And that's where the selling comes in. Okay, the fourth point, then, is salesmanship. Salesmanship is selling. A lot of salespeople don't like to sell. I find it unbelievable the number of salespeople that are almost ashamed of being salespeople, and they use the "aw shucks, golly gee willikers, don't guess you'd want to buy this, would you?" kind of approach to selling. I mean, selling isn't hail fellow, well met, back slapping and joke telling, and it's not super aggressive and so forth, but it's being straightforward and honest with the customer and telling them about features, advantages, benefits, unique selling points, et cetera, all the stuff that people have read about, but they don't really want to do, or seemingly many salespeople don't really want to do. And then the last thing is delivery. And when I say delivery, I mean delivering, installing, getting the job done on time as promised, not early, not late, and no excuses. You know, the cheap guy's excuses are every bit as useful as the expensive guy's excuses. Nobody pays big bucks for excuses. Why should they? You know, if you have a reputation in your business of doing the job on time as promised, and you can prove that, and the way you can prove that is with testimonials. When you're talking to a customer, say, you know, this job will be done by whatever, or you know, we have it in stock and we can deliver tomorrow, you know, or whatever the delivery thing is. If you do that consistently all the time, you can prove that simply from testimonials from your customers. So when someone starts hammering the selling organization about price, if you let price become the issue, it's because you haven't bothered to try to sell.
Yeah, you know, so many of the things that you're saying, Larry, are very powerful, and it's what I teach members of my club. You know, going down the list you gave, price, obviously, that's not one of the ways that I teach to sell on, is price.
Sure.
Absolutely not. But the other four, quality, service, salesmanship, and delivery, you know, I teach over 27 ways to create a zero-resistance sales environment, and a lot of those have to do with those four things that you mentioned, being different,
sure,
superior, and the testimonials are a huge factor. So,
oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and a lot of salespeople, I mean, you know, it amazes me. Our personal study or estimate of testimonial selling, we estimate that fewer than one in four salespeople actually do anything under the heading of testimonial selling. And it's a tragedy because it is so powerful when it comes to persuading, convincing buyers to buy.
Well, I tell you, one out of four, I'd say, would be wildly optimistic. In my personal experience, I so rarely see it. And what a great opportunity for everybody on this call, everybody listening to this down the road, is, you know, I preach and teach and live using testimonials. So what a way to set yourself apart, because nobody's doing it. Very few people. Yeah.
Right.
You know, one of the things you said a minute ago, Larry, that I think is a really good point is that customers don't even realize that they don't buy on price. They'll come into the store, and the only thing that they know to ask is, well, how much is this?
Yeah.
They don't know anything else.
That's right.
And a lot of times, salespeople make the assumption, really what they're hearing is a conversation starter.
Yeah.
And so, but the salesperson, in his own mind, is so paranoid about price that they'll start immediately cutting their own throat, jumping, well, it's, you know, it's really this, but our normal price is this, you know, leaving the door open to negotiations.
Yeah.
I teach, and I know you do too, Larry, is if somebody asks about price, I immediately steer them away and say, well, I'd love to talk to you, you know, about that. Let me ask you a few questions.
Yeah.
And by the time you get into the conversation, that was just a conversation opener for them. So a lot of really good stuff there. Now, in your book, you say that price is virtually always more important in the mind of the seller than in the mind of the buyer. So what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is almost always the seller has price on the brain more than the buyer does. As you just said, buyers often think they buy on price. They'll tell you they buy on price, and they believe it, and they can be really persuasive when they say, you know, price is the only thing we look at. But again, their behavior belies that statement. But the problem is this. If the salesperson has price on the brain, then the salesperson is going to think it's a price issue. I say in my seminars, I'd fire any sales rep that worked for me who was a price buyer. And the reason I say that, you know, I mean, because I got an audience of salespeople sitting there, and they go, well, what do you mean? Well, if you, as a salesperson, are very price-oriented, you will see a whole lot more price buyers than actually exist. The psychologists have a term for that, and it's called projection. One projects or imputes their feelings and emotions to other people. That's the guy who says, I'm just like everybody else. I put my pants on like everybody else. I pull them down over my head. Not everybody gets dressed pulling their pants down over their head. And, you know, some of our listeners probably say, well, I don't think anybody gets dressed that way. Well, probably not. But, you know, I can give you four different ways that people put their pants on. Left leg first, right leg first, standing or sitting. And most of our listeners, if they think about it, they're not going to know how they put their pants on this morning, and they're not going to know until tomorrow morning. And I would advise them that tomorrow morning when they go to do it, to be careful, they better be sitting down, because if they're standing up and get confused, they may fall down. I mean, you know, Well, it's idiotic when people say, well, you know, I know when I buy something, I buy on price. Well, that's not evidence that your customer buys on price. That may be evidence that you do, and even, again, I would argue that that individual who says, yes, I buy on price, probably doesn't buy on price. They just believe they do. You know, one way to kind of look at that is, again, back to the question, are you wearing the cheapest shirt you could buy? I can remember once I was in New York, I think it was, in fact, Trump Plaza, I was doing a seminar, and I asked the audience, you know, 150 people in the audience, whatever, who's wearing the cheapest shirt they could buy? And this one guy stood up, and he said, me. And he says, what do you think, $5? And he's got his jacket on. He had a sport coat on. And he pulls his jacket open, and he points his shirt. He says, $5. What do you think about that? And then he pulls up his the sleeve of his jacket and pulls out the shirt sleeve and says, and it even comes in sleeve lengths. And I said, so you bought it strictly on price? Yeah, $5. What do you think? I said, would you have bought it if it didn't fit? Well, no. Well, what was more important, price or fit? Well, I'm not trying to confuse people or think. I'm just trying to get them to think. You know, and you can go further than that. You know, would you have bought it if it had been purple with yellow polka dots on it or something? You know, what's more important, color? You know, and a real killer is shoes. You're wearing the cheapest shoes you can buy. Would you have bought them if they didn't fit? I mean, you want some pain, get some shoes that don't fit you right. You know?
Exactly.
And yet these are people, because this guy was so genuine and said, me, $5. He was proud of showing his $5 shirt. But price was not the most important. Fit was, and he then said, well, he wanted, I believe it was a light yellow shirt, but he wanted a light, yeah, and he looked nice. I mean, you know, he was well-groomed. But the facts are, he thought he had bought that shirt on price, but he didn't.
No, not at all. And so on that line of thinking, which I believe is 100% accurate, nobody buys on price.
Yeah.
Because if the thing doesn't match what they need, if it doesn't fit, if it doesn't look good in their house, whatever, they're not going to buy it.
You couldn't
give it to them for free.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, they wouldn't have it in their home.
Exactly. You know, if everybody bought on price, everyone would drive a Yugo and eat at McDonald's.
Yeah.
And that's just the plain truth of the matter. What I'm hearing you say, Larry, that's so important, is get out of your own way.
Yeah.
It's in your own head. I tell you, this is going back over a decade, when I really got away from the price thinking, and once I got out of my own way and began to use the other four things, not price, but quality, service, salesmanship, and delivery, I was surprised at how seldom I got price resistance.
It
just didn't happen that often, and it really illustrated to me how much had been in my own head.
Sure.
Yeah. And once I began to do that, then when I did get the occasional price objection, I had my unique selling propositions, my guarantees, the testimonials, and I'd hit them back with that. And you said something interesting earlier, too, Larry. You said, you know, get in their face. And I agree. You get somebody who's really starts hammering you with price, well, you in a professional way, you get in their face and say, here, do they have a no regrets guarantee? Do they have this? You know, how about the, you know, testimonials and all the other things that we're not going to go into a lot of detail on, but it gives you a psychologically in your own mind the ability to stand up to them.
Yeah, you just triggered the thought in my mind. You know, if price were the only reason anybody bought anything, only one seller would sell all there is that's sold of whatever that is, and that's whoever could survive the longest at the lowest price till everybody else went broke. That doesn't happen. But the second thing that I think is really important is this. If price were the only reason anybody bought anything, we would not need sales reps. If price were the only criterion in a purchase decision, we could handle all sales transactions in today's electronic world a electronically, and you wouldn't even need a computer. You could do it with a fax machine. But, you know, people don't buy on price. And you know, why is that customer standing there telling you repeatedly, well, yeah, I like the color, and well, yeah, I like this, and I like it, but price is the only thing that I look at. Why is he telling you? Why isn't he down the street buying from somebody else?
Yep.
So why doesn't he just do a 180 and leave if he's in your store, say? You know, if he's on the phone, why didn't he just hang up?
Yep. And they don't do that.
No.
Very, very seldom. Now, what are some of the attitudes and language used by salespeople that invites their client to beat them up on price?
Well, there's two things that I say that salespeople do that invite, encourage customers to beat them up on price. One is wowing, W-O-W as in wow, and the other is cracking, C-R-A-C-K. What I mean by wowing is when a salesperson unfortunately successfully communicates to the prospective customer that the salesperson feels their price is high. For example, the customer asks the sales rep, you know, how much is this? And the sales rep's reaction is, are you setting down? Better buckle your seatbelt before I lay this price on you. You think $200 would be too much? Don't guess you'd want to pay $200, would you? How do you feel about $200? The minute you communicate, again, unfortunately, successfully communicate to the customer that you feel your prices are high, you're wowing at your own price. And any astute customer